Tonight on Arena, we celebrate last night's five Irish Oscar wins, and Mike Scott and Pat Thomas on their show on beat poet Allen Ginsberg. Five one double 51 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. What a 24 hours and a little bit more. It has been a joy and delight for lovers of Irish film. Let us indulge ourselves once more and listen to that glorious moment from the very early hours of this morning.
I'm a little overwhelmed. Thank you to the Academy. Chris Nolan and Emma Thomas, it's been the wildest, most exhilarating, most creatively satisfying journey you've taken me on over the last 20 years. I owe you more than I can say. Thank you so much. Every single crew member, every single cast member on Oppenheimer, you guys carried me through. All my fellow nominees, I remain in awe of you guys, truly. I want to thank my incredible team. Big shout out to Craig Bankey, Brendan Murphy, Mary Murphy, Yvonne McGuinness, my partner in life and art, my two boys, Malachy and Aaron, who are sitting up there. I love you so much. And I'm a very proud Irish man standing here tonight, so. you know, we made a film about the man who created the atomic bomb, and for better or for worse, we're all living in Oppenheimer's world, so I would really like to dedicate this to the peacemakers everywhere.
And that was, of course, Oscar winner Cillian Murphy accepting his Best Actor award with grace, class and the pitch-perfect couple of focal at the very end of his acceptance speech there. Add to Cillian's success the four wins for Element Pictures and Poor Things, and it really was quite an evening for Irish film. Shortly, we'll be hearing from Tony Award-winning Artistic Director of Druid, Gary Hines. First of all, though, I'm delighted to be joined on the line by a fellow Irish Oscar winner, filmmaker Neil Jordan, who directed Cillian in Breakfast on Pluto back in 2004. Before that, in fact, Neil, just when you hear Cillian accepting, that speech was so perfect. What he got into a minute is quite extraordinary. When you hear that, does it bring back memories of your own night?
Not really, no. Because I never thought I'd win an Oscar, you know. I mean, I just wanted to make movies, and it was... But it became the kind of thing that more and more independent movies were not being nominated for Oscars. Mm. And I was there. It was wonderful to be there when there was a huge audience for the Academy Awards then. I'm not sure what it is now. But, it was great. And, it's a wonderful thing. And I suppose you have to write your speech out, don't you? Otherwise, yeah, you make an absolute fool of yourself in front of all. But I'm so thrilled for Cillian, and I'm so thrilled for everybody involved.
Cillian is the big one, of course, that we're all talking about just on a personal level, but Element Pictures and their four wins as well.
Yeah,
quite extraordinary stuff.
Great, go
back to that moment. 1993, of course, was your own Oscar win in The Crying Game, but the point at which you... cast Cillian Murphy in Breakfast on Pluto. How did that casting come about, Neil?
Well, I had produced a movie he did before that called Intermission with Colin Farrell. And Cillian got word that I had bought the rights to Pat McCabe's novel Breakfast on Pluto. And I began writing a script on that with Pat, and it became this rather wild and wonderful thing. But I didn't want to, because I'd made a movie about a transgender, what we now call a transgender character. I wasn't really anxious to do it again. But Cillian got wind of it and read it, and he asked me would I make it. So I did a test with him, which was extraordinary. And the more I was in two minds about it, the more he kind of said, "Look, when are we doing this? When are we doing this? When are we doing this?" And eventually, I gave up. I said, "Okay, let's do it." And I'm so glad I did, because his performance was absolutely kind of wonderful, magnificent, really. You see an actor at that age when they're stretching their capabilities. It's like watching you know, a kind of horse speaking a huge, great race or something like that. So it's rather wonderful.
Yeah, and even the fact that he got wind of that you had the rights for Breakfast on Pluto, that he made it his business to go off and read the book and to start thinking about the character, it tells us something about his drive and his dedication to what he wanted to do.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he was very, very insistent, A, that he could play the character, and B, that the character was worth playing, you know? And you know, it was an extraordinarily difficult role to play, and it was, but I mean, it was a beautiful thing because for me, the movie took me through the picaresque novel, that script that I'd written with Pat. It took me through all of these kind of different iterations of Irish life, you know, from the 70s in Ireland to kind of those dreadful bombing campaigns in London. And the whole kind of show band era of everything, you know. I mean, the film basically was a vehicle for me to rediscover all those things or to kind of trawl back through all these things through this wonderful character that Killian, you know, came to inhabit so beautifully, really. And we had the strangest thing. And eventually, when he meets his mother in the end, I said to Killian, look, your character really wants to look like Margaret Thatcher in this film. I don't know why. It's because she was such a kind of a barbed icon for a lot of the kind of, you know, a lot of the gay community and stuff like that. And I said, look, let's just do this and see what happens. And he did it, and it was great.
And I mean, what he achieved in that performance alone would, you know, many an actor would, if you got that in your lifetime, you'd be absolutely delighted with yourself.
Well, you couldn't do it now. You couldn't do it now because the whole sexual politics of everything has changed, you know. But he was nominated for a Golden Globe.
Yes.
And by the time it came around, he was so busy shooting another movie with Danny Boyle, it was almost difficult. It was quite difficult to get him even to the ceremony, but we did. But he didn't win that time, but he's won this time. But I think the most remarkable thing that's happened to Killian is, it happens to a lot of Irish, English, or let's say European actors. They, when they're cast in the broader scope of Hollywood movies, they tend to play to the darker characters, you know, the kind of eccentric characters. The, you know, if you think of what's happened to Jeremy Irons and Alan Rickman through their careers, if you think back to Peter Lorre even, beautiful European men often end up playing villains, you know. And Killian did start doing that after he first came to people's notice, when he did Red Eye and when he did the first Chris Nolan picture, you know. But, I mean, he's grown in extraordinary kind of breadth and stature because the character he undertook in Oppenheimer was a kind of an everyman, you know, and kind of a tortured and rather magnificently achieved everyman. So I thought the movie was extraordinary, actually. I've seen it twice. I found it a physical experience. So what Chris Nolan did with the camera in that film is extraordinary, you know.
So a worthy winner of Best Picture as well, then.
I absolutely think so, yeah.
It would seem, I mentioned the four wins for Element Pictures as well, Neil, at the top of the item.
Yeah.
And the massive number of nominations that we had in last year's Oscars. And, you know, the nominations are hugely important as well. Of course, the wins are great, but the nomination is a phenomenal thing in and of itself. Why have we reached what seems to be this absolute golden age of Irish film acting and Irish film production?
Well, I think it's down to Michael D. Higgins, really. I mean, after we had the success with The Crying Game, Michael D. Higgins, who was Minister for Arts, set up the film board again, you know?
Mm.
And he demanded that I and Lydia Doolin and various other people be members of it, you know? And the investment of the Irish state, whatever it's called, in the film industry has been very, very large, very big, and I think it should be acknowledged, really, you know, because, I mean, there are tax breaks now that are not quite as big as they are in Britain, but there is a huge kind of engagement from the Irish Film Board in all kinds of production in Ireland, you know, and I actually thought one of the most significant films that has come out of that was On Colleen Kuhn,
last year.
That beautiful Irish language movie, you know. And the success that you see reflected in Oppenheimer and in Poor Things is kind of emblematic of the fact that it's an international business. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, it's Element Pictures shot that movie with a Greek director in Hungary from an Irish production office, you know, that kind of thing, Killian. It's great that Irish talents can enter into that, the whole international kind of scale and ferment of the whole thing, you know, so...
No, it isn't. And even as you mentioned that, the tax incentive, I suppose we can, as a republic, accept that it is the Irish taxpayer, the man and woman on the street who has...
Have contributed to this, you know?
Yeah.
And it's not always an industry of $200 million movies, nor should it be. You know, it should be an industry of $5 million movies, of $2 million movies, and of $10 million movies as well, you know?
Yeah, funny enough, Cord Jefferson made that very point. I don't know if you heard his speech last night.
I didn't stay up to watch. I kind of knew Killian would win.
Yeah.
But the thing is that this has been an extraordinary year for movies, you know? And it's stunning that there's been those horrible strikes. There's been the COVID experience, and the death of cinema has been, you know, declared so many times. But I can't think of a year in which I've seen better movies than I have this year. I really can't.
Well, that
makes me feel hopeful for everything, really.
Yeah, and finally then, obviously, bringing you back to that night of your own win for the Crying Game back in 1993. Advice for Killian, and I know you'll tell me he doesn't need any advice from you, but just how to work from what he has achieved over the past period.
Yeah, I'd say it can be hard, you know, because there is a curse of the kind of, particularly the Oscar-winning actor, you know. It happened to Sally Field. She won an Oscar and vanished from sight, didn't she? And it happens to quite a few actors, really. It happened to Hilary Swank, didn't it? She won that wonderful Oscar for that. Boys Don't Cry, and then you kind of didn't see her in a significant movie for a long time again. I just think do what comes from your heart, you know, do what you want, really. And do it well, and I'm sure Killian will do that.
Yeah, well, even as you said, the fact that he moved himself out of that potential villain category into a much broader category seems that he can make choices from the heart and the head. Thanks so much for being with us this evening, Neil. Neil Jordan speaking to us about Killian Murphy's win at the Oscars last night, and joined now by Artistic Director of Druid Theatre Company, Gary Hines. 2004. It was, I think, Gary, when you cast a 29-year-old Killian Murphy as Christy Mahon in the Playboy of the Western World for Druid Singh. When you were casting that role, would you think of him in purely theatrical terms, or would the film work and even the success that he had achieved at that point would have come into your orbit at all, Gary?
To be honest with you, I can't actually remember. Certainly when I would be casting somebody like Killian, the issue would be, do I want him to play, can he play the role that I want him to play? And in a way, his being in movies would not make any difference. And, you know, he was Christy Madden as far as I was concerned, and I was thrilled that he did it.
Yeah, and I mean, an emblematic character, or, you know, a very significant character in terms of the Irish canon, you would have to say, in Christy Mahon.
Absolutely.
What do you remember of working with Killian and how he approached a part like that, which, you know, has such a load of baggage all around it when you take on a play from the canon, for starters, but that character in particular?
Yeah, I mean... he is a very hard worker. He knows what he's about. He needs to know what he's about. I mean, everything is involved. As with the best actors, with Killian, everything is involved. The head's there, the heart's there, the soul is there, and the collaboration with the people around you. Because, you know, that's what you have to do, particularly in theatre. And he's just a joy to work with.
Yeah, it is. I thought that was significant in his speech. Every single crew member, every single cast member, he acknowledged every single person. He thought of the film as an ensemble work in much the same way as people talk about ensemble pieces in theatre.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Killian knows who he is, where he is, and what he wants to be, and that makes a huge difference in terms of what he can produce as an actor, and now as an Oscar-winning actor, I'm so utterly thrilled for him.
I haven't heard anyone a negative word anywhere in the past 24 hours, and long may that continue. The absolute delight, his own pride in his being Irish, and I think everybody's pride in what he said and did, not only in the movie, but how he handled himself last night. This is a huge moment, obviously, for Cillian himself winning that prize. Yeah. Element Pictures, as I've mentioned already, winning 4 Oscars last night as well. How does that feed across the general arts community, do you think, Gary, in Ireland?
I think it really does feed across the general arts community in a great way. I think, obviously, you know, in terms of the ability to identify what it must be like for somebody like Cillian to go up there and say, I'm a very proud Irishman, which is a great thing to say. And then to connect with the range of awards that Element won with their movie. I mean, this is Ireland, if we want to look at this like that, and we are, of course. This is Ireland scoring on all levels. Mm. And you know, in something that 30, 40 years ago, nobody could have imagined happening.
And Neil Jordan picking out, you know, the kind of investment that has gone into to film over the past 20, 30 years, that it's the fruits of that that we're beginning to bear now. Do you see a relationship? Go ahead, sorry.
No, absolutely. It is the fruits of that we're beginning to, and we've been seeing already. But the other thing about it is, it's people like Neil himself, who way, way back was the person who started creating. There were those people who took the first steps 30 or 40 years ago, and Neil was one of those people. Mm. And, you know, we're not here without that history supporting us to that moment, if you like.
And what about the relationship between, particularly since we're talking about acting in many ways, that relationship between the theatre world and the film world? How do they interact? How do they feed off each other? How do they, I suppose, a rising tide, does it raise all boats in that respect?
Yeah, well, I think it probably does generally. It can sometimes be difficult for people to maintain a movie career and a theatre career, because they tend to work in such different kind of structures, different kind of timelines and so on and so forth. But, you know, we're lucky, I mean, that those people like Cillian have maintained their work in the theatre. He's never not done theatre, despite the fact that he was a successful film actor from the very beginning. And it means then that you know, both kinds of work are enriching each other, and that's terribly important.
I mean, and even at that point when he did the Druid Playboy and went to those, you know, your tour at the time, which included playing on the Aran Islands, where you might have had 100 people in some audiences. We're not talking about playing to huge, not necessarily huge auditoriums full of 1,000+ people. These were very intimate venues. Was there something about having a star in the midst of all of that? Or is Cillian Murphy just one of those people that he puts that to the one side and gets on with it?
Oh, he just puts that to the one side and gets on with it, as most of those people do. You know, when they go to somewhere like Inishman or Inishir or whatever, the star is the place itself and the people who have come to see it, not them.
Yeah. Well, listen, Gary, I know I can hear your absolute delight for Cillian and for Element Pictures as well this evening. Thanks so much for joining us on the programme.
Thanks.
That's Gary Hines, Artistic Director of Druid Theatre Company, talking about Cillian Murphy back in the day, 2004, and playing the part of Christy Mahon in Playboy of the Western World. Joining us now is Leslie O'Toole, LA-based a journalist and an editor for the likes of the LA Times and Variety. Lovely to have you with us this evening, Leslie. Obviously, you can imagine how much happiness there is in Ireland. Yep. I mean, 5 Oscar wins is quite extraordinary by anybody's measure. Was there a sense of that? Did you pick up a sense of, you know, a great night for the Irish? Or is that us at home just feeling that?
I didn't. And I went to the reception at the Irish consulate on Thursday for the nominees, and I spoke with Robbie Ryan and Ed Gainey. Robbie Ryan is the cinematographer of Poor Things, and Ed Gainey, of course, is one of Element's founders. And they didn't particularly feel, you know, the Irish Wave Part 2 coming after last year's phenomenal 14 nominations. Mm. And I think in part that's because Poor Things' wins were certainly one of the surprises of the show. And the categories that they won in were considered as categories where the less favoured films might actually take home their one Oscar. Mm. You know, Barbie, for example, was favoured for production design. Maestro was favoured for makeup and hair. Likewise, Barbie was favoured for costume design, and those films, you know, ultimately went away almost empty-handed, besides Barbie's best song win, of course. So there might be less goodwill towards the Irish from those films, but I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think that they were possibly being slightly self-effacing. And, you know, Robbie Ryan still thinks that everything trickles down from the Irish acting talent, and said to me, you know, there is a constant flow of that. You know, whatever's in the water in Ireland creates this constant flow of amazing actors, and that trickles down to have the same effect on all the other crafts. So actually, thinking about the bigger picture, I'm not sure that it was such a surprise.
Yeah.
Really.
I was just going to say, let's have a listen to, because the big surprise in terms of the wins last night for Element was Emma Stone winning Best Actress. That just was not expected at all. Let's have a listen to part of her acceptance speech.
The other night, I was panicking, as you can kind of see, happens a lot, that maybe something like this could happen. And Yorgos said to me, please take yourself out of it. And he was right, because it's not about me. It's about a team that came together to make something greater than the sum of its parts. And that is the best part about making movies, is all of us together. And I am so deeply honored to share this with every cast member, with every crew member, with every single person who poured their love and their care and their brilliance into the making of this film. And Yorgo, thank you for the gift of a lifetime in Bella Baxter. I am forever thankful for you. Thank you for inviting all of us to be members of this team. Thank you.
There we go, Emma Stone accepting her Best Actress award. And joining me is Leslie O'Toole, LA-based journalist. Of course, Lily Gladstone was expected to be the winner there, and I think that was one of the biggest surprises on the evening. Overall, Leslie, was it a successful... did Jimmy Kimmel do well? Was it a successful night last night in terms of its presentation?
I think it was very successful. I think there's a very good feeling here in Hollywood and beyond about the show. I think it was a very uplifting celebration of the critically and commercially successful films. I love that, you know, Ryan Gosling's I'm Just Ken moment had that entire arena on its feet. And despite all the, you know, pre-show publicity about Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig's perceived snubs as Best Actress and Director, respectively, you know, they were the first on their feet and so joyous. And there just seemed to be such a fabulous atmosphere. Yeah. And
it was also a highly politicized night.
It was, but it was slightly less political than I anticipated. There were so many people on the red carpet wearing red pro-ceasefire badges, and I expected there to be a lot more chat than there actually was. I thought what Jonathan Glazer said was beautifully measured.
Let's listen to his acceptance speech, obviously. First of all, Jonathan Glazer.
All our choices were made to reflect and confront us in the present, not to say look what they did then, rather look what we do now. Our film shows where dehumanization leads at its worst. It shaped all of our past and present. Right now, we stand here as men who refute their Jewishness and the Holocaust being hijacked by an occupation which has led to conflict for so many innocent people. Whether the victims of October the... Whether the victims of October the 7th in Israel or the ongoing attack on Gaza, all are victims of this dehumanization. How do we resist? Alexandra Bistron Kaladze-Hcek, the girl who glows in the film as she did in life, chose to. I dedicate this to her memory and her resistance. Thank you.
And that's Jonathan Glazer there accepting the award for Zone of Interest at the Oscars last night. Leslie O'Toole with us this evening from LA. He packed a lot into his minute there for sure. Was there a lot of adverse online reaction to that, or has that calmed down at this point, Leslie?
No. I think the most interesting thing that perhaps has not been widely reported globally is that there was a huge pro-Palestine protest outside the show. The Los Angeles Police Department, they can't seem to produce an accurate figure, but they've said between 500 and 1,000 protesters were right there at Hollywood and Highland. And that is actually why the show started 5 minutes late. That never, ever happens. Mm. But people like Margot Robbie and Greta Gerwig and Ryan Gosling were not in their seats when the show was due to start, because those protesters did actually prevent people getting in on time. So I do think that's quite interesting.
For sure.
So it's almost as if that was the loudest protest. But, you know, I think it was very powerful that Billie Eilish and her brother wore that pro-ceasefire pin on stage. Didn't reference it, but I think by then most people watching were aware of what that signified.
A very interesting night, it seems, all round then, Leslie.
Absolutely. And I do think, I mean, you know, Element is doing so phenomenally well now. You know, it's almost like its own mini studio. I mean, Emma Stone has already completed her next film, Kinds of Kindness, with Yorgos Lanthimos for Element Pictures, also shot by cinematographer Robbie Ryan. And, you know, as Robbie noted, you know, it is a global business and everyone travels and everybody loves working with the Irish. You know, I do think there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, but for sure, there's no question that if you're an actress, you might want to work with Element Pictures. They have a good track record in the best actress category. Leslie, thanks for being with us this evening.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That's Leslie O'Toole there reporting to us directly from LA on the highlights of last night's 96th Academy Awards. And you can see edited highlights of the Oscars this evening on RTE2 television. And that is at 9:35. The New Theatre in Temple Bar is offering a really special show tomorrow night. It's a celebration of the great beat poet, Allen Ginsberg, famed for his glorious howl. The night is called Celebration of Allen Ginsberg, Poetry and Song. Let's hear Ginsberg himself performing from that seminal work, Howl.
I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, dragging themselves through the Negro streets at dawn, looking for an angry fix. Angel-headed hipsters burning for the ancient heavenly connection to the starry dynamo and the machinery of night, who poverty and tatters and hollow-eyed and high sat up smoking in the supernatural darkness of cold water flats, floating across the tops of cities, contemplating jazz, who bared their brains to heaven under the L and saw Mohammedan angels staggering on tenement roofs illuminated, who passed through universities with radiant, cool eyes, hallucinating Arkansas and Blake-like tragedy among the scholars of war.
There we have the legendary Beat Generation poet of protest, Allen Ginsberg, performing Howl, part of it. Ginsberg and his poetry, connection and music and activism will be celebrated in Celebration of Allen Ginsberg, Poetry and Song. This is at the New Theatre in Dublin tomorrow evening. The night promises a visual history of the legendary Beat Generation poet, exploring his connection with Bob Dylan, Van Morrison, Jack Kerouac, William Burroughs and many more. Delighted to be joined by the man behind the event, Pat Thomas, author of Material Wealth, Mining the Personal Archive of Allen Allen Ginsberg and by singer-songwriter Mike Scott, who is performing at the event tomorrow evening. You had access to this extraordinary archives, which is where the book came from and the CD that accompanies the book. I think what we just heard is part of that.
That's
that particular CD, Pat. It's a phenomenal archive and about a phenomenal man, really.
Yeah. Allen never threw anything away. He kept every letter, every note, everything. And before he died, it all got passed on to the iconic Stanford University in California. And what was amazing about it is he kept hate mail. He kept love letters. He even kept, this is really crazy, you know, the American Nazi Party wanted to assassinate him for being gay, communist, and Jewish. And he actually wrote a letter to them and said, can we get together and talk about my potential assassination? That's in there. Right. I mean, incredible stuff.
Yeah, he was something else. Mike Scott, obviously, when I think of you and poetry and music, I immediately think of An Evening with Mr. Yeats. This is an entirely different proposition. Yeats going to rock and roll or into rock music is quite a journey. Ginsberg going to rock music, possibly an easier journey, is it?
Well, Ginsberg was a huge influence on the rock generation, a huge influence on Bob Dylan. If you didn't have Ginsberg and Jack Kerouac, you wouldn't have got Dylan in the way that he used words and language. Mm. And then if you didn't have Dylan, there's an awful lot more since then that you wouldn't have. So we all owe Ginsberg a big debt.
And do you feel that even spoke directly into what you have done yourself in your music career?
I would be more indirectly influenced by Ginsberg because Dylan was a great influence on me when I was a kid. I was listening to Dylan at 11. Ginsberg was a guy who I saw on posters. I remember a poster of him holding up this sign that said, "Pot is fun." And I remember asking my mum, "What does that mean?" And she sort of hummed and hawed. And so Ginsberg, I suppose he was a rebellious, slightly mischievous influence on me from an early age, if you like.
Yeah, okay. Rebellious and slightly mischievous.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm wondering what's in the Mike Scott archives that we might explore at some point in the future. Are you a hoarder like Ginsberg?
No, I'm not.
Throw it away. No. Destroy the evidence. Is that the...
You know, Pat was talking to me about Bob Dylan. Apparently Bob Dylan did that as well. And Andy Warhol kept everything. No, I'm not cut from that cloth.
You're not cut from that particular cloth. I think one of the things that you want to get from this, Pat, and from this event, and obviously from the book as well, we think of Ginsberg and we think of the Beat Poet. That's it. We kind of, for many people, that's the frame of reference. That's only the tip of the iceberg, I think, as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, you know, there was something in the 1950s called the Beat Generation, the Beat Generation writers. They were rebelling against the conservatism of post-World War II America, the Eisenhower administration, Joe McCarthy, who was on a commie witch hunt. And so the key figures, of course, are William Burroughs, Jack Kerouac, the legendary On the Road, Ginsberg, Gregory Corso. So he spearheads this. And it's before the counterculture kind of has a name. But not only Bob Dylan, but the Beatles, Van Morrison, many icons of the 60s are picking up on this. Allen totally plugs into the anti-Vietnam War movement. He plugs into what we call the Woodstock generation, the hippie generation. And then by the 1970s, he's inspiring Patti Smith and The Clash. He's being gay, obviously, he's a spearheading gay rights. And so he really is a key member of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, which what other poet could you say that about? Really?
And also, I think within the collection as well, I think this is in the book as well, isn't it? A reproduction of the. He attended to, Ginsberg did. The first ever poetry reading of Patti Smith in the 1970s,
he has that.
See, he's kept stuff that, you know, Patti probably didn't realize she was going to be a legend. She didn't realize that. So he's kept the 1971 very simple paper flyer that she probably Xeroxed for 10 cents, right?
But
that's
the kind of
guy. In 1974, he goes to see Bob Dylan and he runs into Yoko Ono. He scribbles her phone number on the back. Like, who would keep that, you know?
Allen Ginsberg.
Ginsberg.
You mentioned the influence of Ginsberg on Dylan, Mike. I have Going to San Diego here, which features this particular track. Tell us a little bit about this and where you see the interaction between Ginsberg and Dylan.
Well, Ginsberg and Dylan got together in the early 70s and recorded some music together with Ginsberg singing. You know, the whole world was probably waiting to hear Bob sing because he'd been retired for a while. But here's Ginsberg singing. And Ginsberg is a very pleasing... He doesn't have a... It's not a sort of cordial voice that a singer would normally have, but there's a very pleasing tone to it. There's a sort of... It's that word mischief again, and there's an innocence, an earnestness, I think, to his singing. I like his voice a lot.
Let's have a listen to Going to San Diego with Ginsberg singing.
Come to San Diego, whole world gonna swing. I'm going to San Diego, let them brass bells ring. Oh, Mr. San Diego, find out what my future brings. Going to San Diego, walk out on that street. Going to San Diego, hello whoever I meet.
There we go. Allen Ginsberg singing. Bob Dylan in the background there, Pat?
Bob Dylan playing guitar, backing vocals. I just want to point out, this is a very much the anti-Nixon. Nixon is still in the White House. And long before the Americans were not happy with Donald, we were not happy with Richard. And Dylan and Allen bonded on the anti-Vietnam War protests and getting Nixon out of the White House.
When we were listening to that, Mike Scott, we were talking about the quality of Ginsberg's voice. There's something almost old world about it, and something old world in that version of the song as well, I think.
There's a goodness to his character. I hear it. Clear as day. A goodness.
And what, define that goodness for me.
It's an ethical reliability. I would trust that man.
And I guess that's what many of that generation did, Pat. They trusted what he was saying, and the fights that he was, you know, not picking isn't the right word. The fights that he was very strongly ethically behind.
Yes. Well, the word I would use with Allen is integrity. You know, Allen is, you know, I already rattled off his influence culturally and politically. You know, now we trumpet people on social media for doing absolutely nothing, right? This was an era when you actually had to do something. You had to write a book. You had to record an album. And then you became iconic. Now you just throw out a few fancy tweets and, oh my God, isn't this guy clever? Allen was truly clever.
And talk to me a little bit about the relationship between Ginsberg himself, Kerouac, and Neil Cassidy, who was in many ways, I suppose, he was the muse for On the Road.
Well, you know, Jack was politically conservative and grew up in a very conservative household, French-Canadian, very Catholic. And so Neil was the bad boy, right? Mm. The womanizer driving, you know, 100 miles an hour, never hitting the brakes. And so Kerouac was enamored with Neil, as was Allen. That was one of Allen's first sort of male crushes, if you will. And for those of you who've read On the Road, Neil Cassidy is the key character. It's Dean Moriarty. Kerouac is Sal Paradise. So Neil is this, he's kind of just this all-American bad boy. And he later went on to inspire Ken Kesey in the Merry Pranksters, and the Grateful Dead were enamored with Neil Cassidy. He was just this sort of larger-than-life character.
The aspect of it, I suppose, in On the Road was possibly an easy sell, if there is such a thing, in terms of the beat poet. But if you think of Kerouac, if you think of William Burroughs, rather, and Junkie, that was a much harder sell, was it?
Yeah, because, you know, here's the thing. I'm attracted to Ginsberg because he feels like this warm and fuzzy granduncle. Kerouac is the romantic American driving across the West. And Burroughs is reptilian, right? I couldn't imagine giving Burroughs a hug.
Were you a reader of this material, Mike Scott?
I was a reader of Kerouac and some of Ginsberg, but never of Loathsome Cowboy Bill.
You couldn't take
the Burroughs? Never been drawn, Sean. It's never enticed me between the covers of a book.
I want to listen to Hum Bomb because I think this is a real interaction of poem and music in, yeah. In a kind of way. Just, you're going to say something about it, Pat, before we listen?
Just, yeah, for jazz fans out there, the drumming is the legendary Elvin Jones, who played with Coltrane and Many Giants, and it's just, you know, almost just drums and vocals. Very incredible.
Boom, bomb, we bomb them. 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 Boom, bomb, you bomb you. 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 What do we do? Who do we bomb? 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 What do we do? You bomb them. What do we do? You bomb them. What do we do? We bomb them. What do we do? We bomb. We
That's
bomb
Hum
them.
Bomb from Allen Ginsberg. That's one of the. Will we be hearing that tomorrow night, Pat, as part of the event? Or you're being cagey about what who'll be doing what?
I'm going to play some of these songs more in their entirety tomorrow and talking about them.
Yeah. And you were talking about just the quality of what we heard there, Mike. That could have been done yesterday.
It's a killer groove, and Alan's right in the pocket with Elvin Jones. And the character in Alan's voice, the amount of expression per syllable is seriously good.
Because what I was struck by some of the material I was listening to today was, of course he's a beat poet, of course there's a kind of a musicality there, but there is an amazing musicianship there. That's a very musical performance, not just a poetic one.
It's also an early form of, you know, I consider Alan one of the first rappers, you know, hip-hop. You know, this track, I'm not sure the exact date. I think it's late 70s. Mm. But there's also this lineage with, you know, this popular black music of the last 30 or 40 years, right? You know, that the track we heard going to San Diego is a little bit of a rap.
Yeah, and when Alan's doing the stream of consciousness lyrics with all the words tumbling over each other, it's like fast rap from 2023, 24.
So you're not going to tell me what you want it to be a surprise, what the performance is tomorrow night, I think.
The only thing I want to say is this is a rare chance to hear Mike sing Allen Ginsberg songs.
Unique.
Yeah, unique.
Yeah.
Maybe not. Maybe it's the start of a wonderful relationship.
I hope so, yes.
Yeah, well, we'll see. We'll hear what you sing tomorrow night and we'll see where it goes from that. Because maybe, I suppose, the Yeats thing started as a kind of a one song and then became something else, didn't it?
It did, yeah. Yeah, I've actually put one of Alan's poems to my own music and I really like how it's come out. And if it sounds good at the show, maybe I'll record it with the Waterboys.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, yeah. We look forward to hearing that. The event tomorrow night is called...
A Celebration of Allen Ginsberg.
A Celebration of Allen's Poems and Songs. And it will take place at the New Theatre. Thenewtheatre.ie will give you all of the details there. Garvey's Ghost is an evening of folk music, poetry and discussion exploring the complicated history of Black Irish solidarity from the famine through to the Ulster Civil Rights Movement. The show traces the history of Marcus Garvey, the Harlem civil rights activist who took inspiration from the 1916 Rising. The evening will be presented by Emma Dabry and features Bernadette Devlin McAliskey, Dagogo Hart, Lenny Sloan and McDara Yates. It's all part of UBER, the annual Oral Traditions programme taking place as part of the St. Patrick's Festival, which explores the Irish tradition of storytelling, song and oral history and traces their links around the world. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by the curator, McDara Yates, and academic writer and broadcaster Emma Dabry, who joins us on the line from London. Let's start with this character of Marcus Garvey. Extraordinary man, and even that name Garvey tells a very sad part of his background, in fact, McDara.
Absolutely. Well, I guess the thing about some of the most fascinating people on this earth are their contradictions, right? Mm-hmm. Marcus Garvey is a man whose name was bestowed upon him by an Irish slave owner who would have lorded over the plantation that his family came from in Jamaica. However, sometime in the future he would find inspiration for, I suppose, African-American liberation from the Irish 1916 rising. And I guess that is what we're doing with this event here. We're tracing some of the fascinating people who've looked to Ireland for inspiration from the African-American perspective.
And how did Garvey come across the 1916 story and that aspect of Irish Revolution?
Yeah, I guess it's easy to forget just how far the events of Easter Week 1916 spread around the world. I mean, it was on the front paper of newspapers in India and things like that. So presumably Garvey was just a reader of the newspaper and it made its way to Upper Manhattan, where he was living at the time.
And Emma joining us on the line from London, Emma Dabry. How do you see the relevance of Marcus Garvey, Emma, in today's context, especially in this idea of Black Irish solidarity, which is what the event is going to be all about in many ways?
Yeah, first of all, can I just say thank you so much for pronouncing my surname properly, because that so rarely happens. Deeply appreciated.
I was helped, let us be honest. But anyway.
It's such a rare occurrence that I'm excited. So Garvey and like beyond Garvey, I think the notion and the very, like, the reality of international solidarity, like, I believe, is really the only way of bringing about the type of transformations that we need to be able to bring about in order to address, like, most of the current kind of crises that our world is experiencing. I really strongly believe in the power of coalition and in the necessity of having people who have struggles that are maybe perceived as being different and will be different in many ways, also being able to identify common ground and seeing how there's often like a common root to their struggle, and often the type of oppression, the origin of the oppression that it is that they're resisting, often has the same source, and people being able to identify that, I think, is like a really powerful tool of resistance that we have against oppression and exploitation. I think for me, on a personal level, being both Black and Irish, and that being something that I found quite difficult to reconcile in the kind of earlier part of my life, I was doing research. I was looking for ways to make sense of myself, and I came across all of the, as well as like a very troubled history often between Black and Irish people, particularly in the United States, I also came across all of these examples of solidarity. Yeah. and shared histories that are fascinating.
Tell me a little bit about, I love where yourself and MacDara kind of hooked up in terms of this event and in terms of this interest in Marcus Garvey.
Yeah, so I met MacDara because I was in the Gaeltacht in Donegal in St. Columbkill trying to reacquaint myself with the Irish language. And his dad was actually my teacher. And then MacDara was there teaching the Baron. And we had a conversation like one night. That was how we first met. And then I think he reached out to me after he heard me speaking with Bernie Sanders. And I was talking, Bernie Sanders had brought out a folk album in the 1980s. And I was talking to him about the kind of relevance of folk music in my own life and the Ballad of James Connolly, which was a song, one of the first songs I ever learned. And I think MacDara heard me talking about that. And he was just like, let me get in touch with her about this project, which was right up my street. So I was delighted.
Yeah, and of course, like many Irish people, your relationship with the Irish language, and us in the middle of Seachtain na Gaeilge, if we know her, your relationship with the Irish language wasn't the one that perhaps you wanted to have.
No, it very much wasn't. I saw Irish as something that was kind of irrelevant and punitive. And it was only as I got older that I began to like very much kind of transform my attitude towards it and feel actually a deep sense of kind of like loss at not being able to speak it. So yeah, I've been trying to kind of rehabilitate that relationship.
One of the very interesting things that comes, that is part of this curatorship of yours, MacDara, is the relationship between the Black activist and singer Odetta Holmes, normally just referred to as Odetta, and her relationship with the Clancy brothers.
Absolutely. Well, again, we're talking about these suppose, events and relationships of great solidarity between people of different nations, there was a good bit of sympathy for Irish republicanism and, say, for Ulster and the Ulster struggle in Greenwich Village, in the folk scene in New York in the 1960s, 1970s. And of the many people that crossed paths in that time, one amazing meeting was that of Odetta, the great black civil rights activist and singer, and the Clancy Brothers. And the Clancy Brothers would actually go on to produce Odetta's first ever record on their own label, Tradition Records. It's something that might seem unlikely. At the time, it's said that there were certain conservative members of Irish America that didn't approve of this friendship, but the Clancy Brothers kept on keeping on.
Yeah. And listen to one of the collaborations, a wonderful Irish folk tune and ballad, and a great kind of jazzy riff bass underneath it.
Oh, down the glen I went one morn to a city there rode I, there I
It's just so haunting. That's the voice of Odetta with the Clancy Brothers there.
I don't know if they're actually performing with her on that track, but they recorded, they paved the way for a lot of her early records. Yeah,
and Emma Dabry, as you listen to that, this idea that there's a difference, the voice of Odetta sitting on top of that wonderful jazz bassy line, she could be a native Irish singer of Shan No Song as we hear that song. That's certainly what I'm hearing.
Yeah, I've actually never heard that before. That was like just giving me chills. I need to go and listen to it as soon as I get off the phone.
Yeah, there's 4 minutes incredible. And 50 seconds of it. I'm sorry that I could only play a minute of it. No, to my ears, it's an incredible sound. I know that one of the things that's exciting you enormously about the upcoming event, Emma, is you're going to be talking with Bernadette Devlin McAliskey. Why is that so important to you?
Oh, well, there's so many reasons. Like, I mean, Bernadette is just such an incredibly, like, important person, and she's just been involved in, like, so many kind of, like, key, like, historical moments. But I think, again, like, on a personal level, when I first heard of her talking about her relationship with the Black Panthers, and the Black Panthers being a group, Black American, Black Liberation Group of revolutionary socialists, who's organizing. I think they're known primarily for their militancy, but actually, like, their kind of social organizing is really exciting and a far lesser known kind of aspect of them. But when I heard Bernadette talking about her relationship with them and the parallels that she could see between the way Catholics were treated in Northern Ireland and Black Americans were being treated in America, often by Irish Americans, that she felt more of an affinity with the struggle of the Black Panthers than she did necessarily with some Irish Americans. And when she was given the key to New York City, which was obviously, like, you know, a huge honor being bestowed on her, she handed that over to the Black Panthers. And I was just like, very profound for me.
An incredible move. Well, listen, I'm sure that'll be part of the conversation. There are a whole host of other events. McGarvey's Ghost is just part of it. McDarrett, there's lots happening there as well. I'll give people the details. But thanks to McDarrett and Emma Dabry. Garvey's Ghost takes place this Friday at TU Dublin Grange Gorman Concert Hall as part of ABBER, the St. Patrick's Festival. And you'll find out full details of that and everything happening at the festival, stpatricksfestival.ie. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney was in my violin in charge of the sound. Paula Shields researched, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night. Ihit Javarch, Arish, Shock the Cog, and her RTE Radio Hain. Beg John Creedon live in Yig na Nochta.